Now
on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
The Saturday Morning Update.
Good morning. It is the Saturday Morning Update for a holiday weekend. The award-winning Jeff Wolf is our technician this morning, and of course, Jane Houghton, and our producer. And it is good to have you along with us. A lot of news to cover. The Munich Security Conference 2023 is underway. They're already speaking this morning. President Zelensky speaking a little bit ago, and Vice President Harris will be addressing the Munich Security Conference a little later on this morning. But this is what President Zelensky of Ukraine had to say as we approach the first anniversary of the war in Ukraine that will take place on Friday.
There is no alternative to Ukrainian victory. There is no alternative to Ukraine and in the EU. There is no alternative to Ukraine in NATO. There is no alternative to our unity. We need to hurry up. We need the speed of our agreements, speed of our delivery to strengthen our sling, speed of decisions to limit Russian potential. There is no alternative to speed, because it is the speed that the life depends on.
And, of course, President Zelensky, Russia, the Ukraine war, and China atop the agenda at the Munich Security Conference 2023, which is taking place today. The main story that's been creating a lot of national headlines this week is out of East Palestine, Ohio. The train crash that you've probably heard about by now happened on February 4th. Finally, this week, a cabinet member showed up. Mayor Pete hasn't made it yet. People in Ohio are a little concerned about the administration's response. Bloomberg headline, fury grows over Ohio chemical disaster as Biden offers help. Yeah, Biden offering help 2 weeks later after a firestorm of criticism from residents and politicians and even Aaron Brockovich, which we will get to in a moment. But among the questions being asked by the residents in East Palestine, Ohio, at a town hall earlier this week, is where is the Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg?
Where's Pete Buttigieg? Where's he at?
I don't know. You're just as good as me. Yesterday was the first time I heard anything from the White House.
And that's the mayor, Trent Conaway, mayor of East Palestine, Ohio, trying to respond to one of those town hall questions. Of course, J.D. Vance, the new Republican senator in Ohio, and this is what he had to say on Thursday.
I think that if the EPA administrator wants to stand here and tell people that the tap water is safe, by all means, they should be willing to drink it.
Are you?
No, I just told, I told Tom, I think that if I was living here, I would drink the bottled water for now, better safe than sorry, especially since it's being provided for free. That's the guidance I would give. But again, you know, residents are going to make their own decisions on this, but my honest personal advice is I'd be drinking the bottled water right now.
And the general drift from the officials and the administration have been, well, there's no permanent damage. There's nobody has got anything to worry about, except maybe if you have a well, you might want to test your well water. Well, if you're testing your well water, it means there's chemicals in the ground, doesn't it? Hello. Senator Vance was there yesterday, and he was standing by the river, the Ohio River, scraped the ground with a stick, and here's how he described it.
Hey, guys, so I'm here at Leslie Run, and there's dead worms and dead fish all throughout this water. So, something I just discovered is that if you scrape the creek bed, it's like chemical is coming out of the ground. Can you come here? And let me just show this to people. I don't know if you're going to be able to see this on the camera, but watch this. Just see that chemical pop out of the creek. This is disgusting. And the fact that we have not cleaned up the train crash, the fact that these chemicals are still seeping in the ground is an insult to the people who live in East Palestine. Do not forget these people. We got to keep applying pressure. That's how we're going to fix this problem. Thank you.
And this is all 2 weeks later. On Thursday, the Ohio Governor Mike DeWine said he had asked three federal agencies for assistance. According to the Associated Press, the White House said that President Biden had offered DeWine help, but it's 2 weeks later. Remember Erin Brockovich? Remember the film? Julia Roberts was the actress who starred as Erin Brockovich. Film came out in 2000. And she was at the early stages of her career, a legal clerk, became a whistleblower, a consumer advocate, and environmental activist. And she built the case against Pacific Gas and Electric Company, PG&E. It involved groundwater contamination in Hinckley, California. And it was that investigation of Erin Brockovich's that led to the movie. Anyway, why am I telling you all this? Because Erin Brockovich spoke out this week about the East Palestine, Ohio train derailment.
By not showing up, by not addressing this, that a national train derailment of very hazardous information, you do nothing but create a vacuum of an upset community, a misinformed community, a distrusting community, and it adds to rumors, speculation, losing trust, and a lot of theories. Act like you care about what's going on in your backyard, in this country.
You know, it just seems as though the Biden administration doesn't respond to anything until it's 2 weeks later and it's a national crisis. Except for the border, it's 2 years later and they have yet to respond to that national crisis. But that's a different story. There's questions, of course, about the Secretary of Transportation, Pete Buttigieg. I mean, of course, he does oversee rail transportation in this country, right? Well, Corinne Jean-Pierre was asked about Pete Buttigieg's response at a press briefing late this week, and here's what she had to say.
Hal Steen said yesterday was the first time he had heard anything from the White House about the train derailment. Could you talk a little bit about the White House's outreach and what you plan to do in the days ahead and why you hadn't reached out earlier?
So again, the health and safety of the community is our top priority. I mentioned, I believe on Tuesday, that EPA had been on the ground since February 4th. And so they have been on the ground for some time, but I can give you a little bit of where we are today. President Biden spoke directly to Governor DeWine to offer federal assistance, and the EPA Administrator, Michael Regan, is in East Palestine now. I believe he's going to be holding a press conference in about 20 minutes or so, and to talk about the ongoing efforts and what we're doing on the ground. Multiple federal agencies have been on the ground, as I just mentioned, some of them since February 4th, working hand in glove with the state and local officials who are leading the emergency response efforts.
So Bill Hemmer, Fox News Channel, yesterday morning asked Michael Regan, who is the EPA administrator, what took so long, as Michael Regan finally got there 2 weeks later at week's end. And here's a segment of Bill Hemmer with the EPA administrator.
Nearly 2 weeks for a senior administration official to show up. To you then, sir, what took so long?
Well, you know, I have to say I'm thankful for the emergency responders, including my EPA staff that were on the ground hours after the trail derailment and have been there since. I think we have to be responsible here and understand when you bring in a senior official, especially at the cabinet level, you divert or pull away resources from the emergency response, from the state police and the like. And so we wanted to be sure that the emergency responders had all the resources and the focus to do what they've done. Thankfully, no loss of life, no injuries, and that's because emergency responders and local officials were able to focus on the job.
You'll notice he said no injuries. What about the long-term effects on the residents? And I'm sure you've seen and heard the interviews with the local residents who are complaining about sore throats and headaches, migraine headaches, rashes, and all kinds of things that are happening to them that weren't happening to them prior to this train accident. Mayor Pete, is this going to be Mayor Pete's Katrina or even the Biden administration's Katrina? That's a question that's being asked a lot. And here's a real winner quote from Mayor Pete. Now, keep in mind, he is the Secretary of Transportation, and he oversees America's railroads.
While this horrible situation has gotten a particularly high amount of attention, there are roughly 1,000 cases a year of a train derailing.
1,000 cases a year of trains derailing. It's like, hey, it's just another day on the job here. We have three accidents every day. I mean, what do you want me to do about it? I mean, just to kind of flippantly say, well, we have 1,000 train wrecks a year. I mean, it's fine. Do you not think maybe you want to imply that you're going to take some action, even if you can't or you don't or you won't? Also, Mayor Pete went on. This is always the greatest excuse from federal officials.
I can't get ahead of an investigation that is active and ongoing, but Norfolk Southern will have to answer to EPA for the environmental side.
Okay, I can't get ahead of an investigation. That's the polite way to say I'm not talking about it. It is 6:20. It is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. We will be joined by Jennifer Harper from the Washington Times, Jim Trusty, our legal expert, John Gizzi, the White House correspondent at Newsmax, also Cheryl Atkinson, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, and KT McFarland. The whole gang is in on a holiday weekend, and Al BD is in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In Maryland, first with the Beltway, Inner Loop and Outer Loop in Prince George's County and in Montgomery County, and that tap of the brakes, lanes are clear. In Montgomery County on 270, between the Beltway and Frederick, I have no reports of any delays on the northbound side or on the southbound side. In Prince George's County, first between the two beltways on 95 and the BW Parkway, you're not tapping the brakes northbound or southbound. And on Route 50 in Prince George's County, between the beltway and the Bay Bridge, eastbound lanes are clear and the westbound lanes are clear. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Temperatures much colder to start your weekend. We are in the low 30s this morning, but we'll climb up to around 48 to 49 for that afternoon high, which is normal this time of year. Plenty of sunshine and light west winds at about 10 miles per hour. Tonight, down to the upper 30s, and tomorrow afternoon, middle to upper 50s. A little bit breezy as south winds return around 15 miles per hour. I'm 7 News meteorologist Jordan Evans in the First Alert Weather Center.
28 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:21 on the Saturday Morning Update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
The Saturday Morning Update continues. I'm Rick Fowler. We know how President Biden always talks about the oil companies and why won't they produce oil, and they're creating all the price gouging and everything else. It may be comments like this that discourage the oil companies from going out and wanting to drill a number of new wells. This is the president speaking in Lanham, Maryland, at the end of the week.
You know, this is going to have a major impact on the environment, what we're doing, specifically reducing carbon in the air as we begin to move these 500,000 charging stations around the world, I mean, around the country. And ultimately, it's going to take millions of barrels of oil off the road.
Oh, that's a good way to encourage the oil companies. We'll take millions of barrels of oil off the roads. Well, Nikki Haley has thrown her hat in the ring, and, you know, it probably wouldn't have been too big of a deal if Don Lemon hadn't opened his mouth over at CNN. He opened it so wide that he was not on the air on Friday morning, had the day off. Anyway, this is Nikki Haley, of course, former South Carolina governor, announcing that she is going to run for president in 2024. And here's just part of what she said in her announcement.
In the America I see, the permanent politician will finally retire. We'll have term limits for Congress. And mandatory mental competency tests for politicians over 75 years old.
And you know that Nikki Haley is of Indian descent, but Whoopi Goldberg tore into her on The View.
So, Nikki, you know, since you have been asleep all this time and you just woke up, you're just finding out that there are things about our country that are not perfect. And for us to pretend that it is and that nothing happened is ridiculous. So you're not saying anything new. And you of all people should know better, because you used to actually have some sanity and knew right from wrong.
Yes.
And then you lost your mind and went in some new direction. So don't do that.
I'm not sure it was Nikki Haley that lost her mind. I think it might have been others. Don Lemon, of course, at CNN, formerly in the evening, now on in the morning, but as of Friday, off. Don Lemon lit the world up with this one. This is the full context. You may have heard short clips of this, but the sexist, misogynistic comments of Don Lemon on CNN.
This whole talk about AIDS makes me uncomfortable. I think it's the wrong road to go down. She says people, you know, politicians or something are not in their prime. Nikki Haley isn't in her prime. Sorry. When a woman is considered to be in her prime in her 20s and 30s and maybe 40s.
What do you talk? Wait.
That's not according to me.
Prime for what?
It depends. I mean, it's just like prime. If you look it up, if you Google when is a woman in her prime, it'll say 20s, 30s, and 40s. I don't necessarily.
40s. Oh, I got another.
I'm not saying
decade.
I agree with that. So I think she has to be careful about saying that, well, you know, politicians aren't in their prime.
You need to qualify. Are you talking about prime for, like, childbearing? Or are you talking about prime for being president?
Don't shoot the messenger. I'm just saying what the facts are. Google it. Everybody at home. When is a woman in her prime? It says 20s, 30s, and 40s. And I'm just saying Nikki Haley should be careful about saying that politicians are not in their prime and they need to be in their prime when they serve, because she wouldn't be in her prime according to
Google,
you know, Google or whatever it is.
I'm sorry. That's just classic Don Lemon. Well, that didn't go over so well. And, you know, it's funny. He's talking about Nikki Haley not being in her prime. Well, Don Lemon is not in his prime time anymore now, is he? Nor would I say he's particularly in his prime at all. But moving right along, if you tuned into the morning program on CNN on Friday, here's what you heard.
Good morning, everyone. Audie Cordish is here at the desk with us this morning. Don has the day off. Poppy.
Okay. It is 6:26. It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL, and we have got a lot more to cover. We got an interesting story or two coming up next, so stay with us. And in other news we are covering this morning, of course, the latest on the objects in the sky. After a lot of people had a lot of complaints about the president not speaking, he finally spoke on the matter at the end of the week, and I don't think it was particularly enlightening, but at least he came out and said something.
We don't yet know exactly what these three objects were, but nothing right now suggests they were related to China's spy balloon program or that they were surveillance vehicles from any other country. The intelligence community's current assessment is that these three objects were most likely balloons tied to private companies, recreation or research institutions studying weather or conducting other scientific research.
So that capped off a week of frustration on Capitol Hill. There was a hearing for senators, a briefing on Tuesday, and when they came out of the meeting, they were not too thrilled, and you'll recognize some of these voices, including Senator John Kennedy at the end, and also Richard Blumenthal, the Democrat from Connecticut.
The American people deserve to hear more from the president.
They provided us basically no answers.
The American people need and deserve to know more.
Lock your doors.
And, you know, Senator John Kennedy is one of my favorites. He elaborated on Wednesday about China.
As they say, the cow is now out of the barn. Mm-hmm. I think the president, this administration has a tendency to ignore problems and ignore issues. I give you the border.
Yeah.
It tends to say, look, you know, while I really admire the problem, I don't want to talk about a solution. I think at this juncture, the president needs to talk straight up to the American people.
And finally, he did at the end of the week. John Tester, of course, senator from Montana, and his comments, you know, some people were saying, well, China, it was inadvertently here, the Chinese saying it was inadvertent. Well, that didn't go over too well with Senator Tester.
Senator, there are some reports that the balloon may have flown inadvertently into U.S. airspace. Is that something that you've heard?
I never believe anything's inadvertent when it comes to the Communist Party of China.
And we got a couple that you may not have heard this week. This is a great headline in the Daily Caller. Strictly forbidden. Canadian official tells New York Mayor Eric Adams to stop busing illegal migrants north. Remember when they complained about Greg Abbott doing that? Now Mayor Adams of New York is doing that? Well, that's what they say. The Quebec Premier, François Legault, his office says the illegal immigration situation in his region of Canada is already overwhelming, like it has been for Adams. That according to the New York Post, Adams has for months criticized Republican Governor Greg Abbott in Texas for busing thousands of illegal immigrants to the Big Apple, leading him to send some of the immigrants to the Canadian border. Quebec Premier François Legault said, quote, any form of assistance to migrants crossing the border, where it is strictly forbidden to do so, should stop immediately. All right, that's clever. It's 6:31. This is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. Albie Dees in the WMAL Traffic Center.
On the Claire Barton Parkway eastbound, there is an accident just east of the Beltway. Eastbound traffic is being diverted onto 495. Heads up in Northeast D.C., New York Avenue eastbound near Bladensburg Road, there is a report of a crash. On 295, 395, and 695 in D.C., I have no reports of any crashes or construction. And on the Beltway, both in Virginia and in Maryland, inner loop and outer loop currently running at speed. Nothing in the road slowing you down. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Temperatures much colder to start your weekend. We are in the low 30s this morning, but we'll climb up to around 48 to 49 for that afternoon high, which is normal this time of year. Plenty of sunshine and light west winds at about 10 miles per hour. Tonight, down to the upper 30s, and tomorrow afternoon, middle to upper 50s. A little bit breezy as south winds return around 15 miles per hour. I'm 7 News meteorologist Jordan Evans in the First Alert Weather Center.
28 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:33 on the Saturday Morning Update.
Headlines, analysis, perspective.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
It is the Saturday Morning Update. President's Day holiday weekend. Thank you for being with us. I'm Rick Fowler. Jennifer Harper is working on another holiday weekend. Good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
She writes.
I love how you put that, yes.
She writes inside the Beltway at the Washington Times, the news never stops. Speaking of the news never stopping, big questions about the balloons. Should we have shot them down or not? And we know what the administration and the Republicans are saying, but what are the American people saying?
Well, they're always interested in this kind of thing. There's intrigue and news and military and UFOs and everything else mixed up in this, so sometimes it's hard to figure out what the heck people actually think. But there is a poll. Here we go with some numbers early in the morning, but this is an Economist YouGov poll which actually asked people, was it the right decision for the U.S. government to shoot down the balloons? And here's what they found. 79% of Americans say it. Yes, it was the right decision to shoot down the balloons, and that includes 88% of Republicans, 68% of independents, and even 85% of the Democrats are all for that. And then it also found that 14% of U.S. adults overall are not sure if it was right or wrong to shoot down surveillance balloons. That includes 6% of Republicans, 24% of independents, and 9% of Democrats, and let's go down to those who think it was the wrong decision. Only 7% of Americans thought that, and that was kind of straight across the board. 7% of Republicans, 8% of independents, and 6% of Democrats. And also the survey asked men and women what they thought about that, and essentially everybody sort of agreed on all that. This was sort of an overwhelming phenomenon, and it was all thumbs up for shooting down those balloons.
You know, we often ask, who's really in charge in the government? Who's in charge of the White House? Well, we all know that former President Obama is in charge of the current White House. But in terms of the Republicans and the Democrats in their respective parties, who's in charge? Wasn't that the name of a TV series that started in the mid-2010s or something?
Indeed. And a lot of people sometimes wonder who the heck is in charge these days. But again, we have a interesting little poll here, lots of interesting numbers, because this is what the question was. Who would you say is the leader of the Republican Party? And believe it or not, this is a serious Associated Press poll. And I always kind of pay attention to their stuff. They're very meticulous over there. And this was an open-ended question. They said, well, who would you say is the leader of the Republican Party? And 21% of the respondents said they don't know who is the leader of the Republican Party. I don't know what that means for the image of the GOP, but let's move right along. They just the results are indicating that they really don't know who the leader of the Republican Party. And these were people volunteering answers. 19% singled out former President Donald Trump, who is the leader of the Republican Party now. 18% skipped or refused to answer the question. 10% cited Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. 9% House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. 9% said no one was the leader of the party. And 5% simply offered different comments and descriptions. They weren't particularly specific about what those comments were. But anyway, let's move along. 3% said Governor Ron DeSantis was in charge of the party. 3% said other, whatever, whoever that is. And 1% cited RNC committee chairman Rona McDaniel. And 1% offered all kinds of names, which could be like Bozo the Clown and things like that. So they really don't pay any attention. Anyway, they also asked about the Democratic Party, asked Democrats, who's in charge of your party? And it found that 28% said that President Biden was the leader of the Democratic Party. Yay. Anyway, 18% of Democrats skipped or refused to answer that question. 17% did not know who was the leader of their party. 9% cited Representative Nancy Pelosi of California. 6% offered those comments and descriptions. 5% cited Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. 5% said nobody was in charge of the party. 3% cited former President Barack Obama. And 2% cited House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries. And 2% cited that ever-popular other. And 1% cited Vice President Kamala Harris. And 1% cited businessman and philanthropist George Soros. And 1% offered those pesky multiple mentions of names. That's who's in charge here, according to this interesting Associated Press poll.
Interesting numbers in there, especially the Ronna McDaniel number. 1% think she's in charge of the Republican Party, and she actually is in charge of the Republican National Committee. So she is in charge of the party, but only 1% of the people think so, so she's got some work to do there.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Well, it is a new Congress, and you had an article this week about the uniqueness of the new Congress.
Yeah, well, let's look at Congress and do it in a positive light. But anyway, here we go. This is some interesting findings from the Pew Research Center. Always on top of lots of things. This was released February the 7th. Here's what they say. The 118th Congress is the most racially and ethnically diverse in history. Overall, 133 lawmakers identify as Black, Hispanic, Asian American, American Indian, Alaska Native, or multiracial. Together, these lawmakers make up a quarter of Congress, including 28% of the House of Representatives and 12% of the Senate. By comparison, when the 79th Congress took office in 1945, non-white lawmakers represented just 1% of the House and Senate combined. And this is the Pew Research Center. They went into all sorts of historic annals and things like that, I believe. But anyway, moving along, despite this growing racial and ethnic diversity, Congress remains less diverse than the nation as a whole. Non-Hispanic white Americans account for 75% of voting members of the new Congress, considerably more than their 59% share of the U.S. population. That's the comparison. And the number of women in Congress is at an all-time high. There are 153 women in the national legislature, accounting for 28% of all members. The total includes 6 non-voting House members who represent the District of Columbia and U.S. territories, 4 of whom are women. In addition, there are 18 foreign-born lawmakers in the 118th Congress, including 17 in the House and 1 in the Senate. That would be Senator Mazie Hirono, a Hawaii Democrat who was born in Japan. It's a lot of information, but it's sort of interesting to think about it, the evolving Congress, Rick.
So, you know, every time they have the huge Davos conference and all of the environmental gurus come in on their private jets for the environmental messaging, creates a lot of interesting news stories. But there is one climate headliner that may be flying commercial next time.
Yeah, well, this is one of these moments where we can't pick on someone anymore, and that would be a special presidential envoy for the climate, drum roll please, John Kerry. He and his family, according to some news report, according to Fox News Digital, actually, They reported that the Carey family has quietly sold their private jet to a New York-based hedge fund following intense criticism of the plane's carbon footprint in light of Carey's work fighting global warming. This is Fox News Digital. And they say the Carey family's private jet, a Gulfstream, G-I-V-S-P, is no longer owned by his family's charter firm, which is called the Flying Squirrel LLC. According to the Federal Aviation Administration registration information that was reviewed by Fox News Digital, they say Secretary Carey travels commercially in his role as Special Presidential Envoy Climate. And this is according to Whitney Smith, who is a spokesperson for Mr. Carey. She said, I can confirm the plane previously owned by his wife's family was sold last summer. So Mr. Carey is indeed appears to be flying commercial.
So we have a golden anniversary coming up, and it's going to be one anniversary party, I understand.
Yeah, let's have a round of applause and a drum roll, please, Rick, for the Heritage Foundation, marking their 50th year of fighting for the everyday American. That's part of their motto there. And essentially, this very well-known conservative policy organization, they were founded on February 16th, 1973. And they are now planning a very fine and very grand celebration in April. You might want to know about, and this is going to showcase conservative leaders and allies, stalwart supporters, original thinkers. And according to Kevin Roberts, he's the seventh president of the Heritage Foundation. He says, ever since Heritage's founding 50 years ago, this organization has dedicated itself to advancing conservative policy with world-class research and analysis and advocacy. Today, we celebrate those who had the vision for Heritage and the accomplishments they achieved on behalf of the American people. I think it's kind of a noble calling. But anyway, they say we have unfinished work and a limited window of opportunity to save this country. Again, this is coming from Kevin Roberts. He's the president of Heritage. He says it is time for an ambitious, audacious, and aspirational conservative agenda to take back this country from an emboldened progressive left. Everything we do is strategically focused on winning battles for the everyday American who our leaders in Washington, D.C. have forgotten. That was according to a written statement from Mr. Roberts. And this is looking like it's going to be a very, very interesting evening. It's going to actually it's a two-day celebration. This is going to be a welcome reception at Mount Vernon right there on the banks of the Potomac, and then a leadership summit and evening gala at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center right across the river there in Maryland. A lot of people who go to CPAC know it well. Anyway, they say the summit will demonstrate consensus around big picture questions facing America and deliver a conservative policy agenda equipped to unite the movement around an offensive strategy to take back our country, restore self-governance, and rebuild key institutions of civil society. I like the sound of that. But anyway, moving along, central to the conservative agenda is Heritage's new policy Bible titled The Mandate for Leadership, The Conservative Promise. And, Rick, that was penned by 365 scholars from around the country. So they're very serious about this, but it looks like going to be a pretty good party. If you're curious about that, coming up probably quicker than we think, go to heritage50.org, and you will find something called 50th that you can click on and see what's going on for this once-in-a-lifetime celebration.
Jennifer Harper, Inside the Beltway, Washington Times. Have a wonderful holiday weekend.
Thanks, and have a good holiday, everybody out there.
6:47 Saturday morning update. Talk to Jim Trustee next, but first, Al BD's in the WML Traffic Center.
In Montgomery County on the Clara Barton Parkway, eastbound just east of the Beltway, there is a crash. Eastbound traffic is being diverted onto the Beltway. On the Beltway in Prince George's County and in Montgomery County, you're not tapping the brakes on the inner loop or on the outer loop. Into Virginia on the Beltway, no delays on the inner loop and on the outer loop. 66 in Fairfax County, it's at speed, eastbound and westbound. And on 95 in Virginia, between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, you're not tapping the brakes in either direction, lanes are clear. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Temperatures much colder to start your weekend. We are in the low 30s this morning, but we'll climb up to around 48 to 49 for that afternoon high, which is normal this time of year. Plenty of sunshine and light west winds at about 10 miles per hour. Tonight, down to the upper 30s, and tomorrow afternoon, middle to upper 50s. A little bit breezy as south winds return around 15 miles per hour. I'm 7 News meteorologist Jordan Evans in the First Alert Weather Center.
28 degrees in the nation's capital, 648 on the Saturday morning update on WMAL.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
It is a Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler. Jim Trusty joins us. He is a member of the Trump legal team. He is a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington and is also the former chief of the organized crime and gang section at the U.S. Department of Justice. Jim, good morning and a happy President's Day weekend. We often hear things in the news, but I'm not sure whether that's leaked or whether it's information.
Yeah, 99% leak. Again, I'm in that position of being able to tell you we're doing a lot of work and we're keeping our eyes on things like the continued searches this time for Vice President Pence, which they did this week. But other than that, no matter how much it gets leaked, we have to sit here and be quiet and just take our swings behind closed doors.
Let's move on to the Alex Murdaugh trial. We've been following that very closely with you. What is the latest at week's end? That has been another 5 days of courtroom drama televised nationally.
Yeah, lots of drama. The state rested their case yesterday. They finished the last of 61 witnesses they called in what is obviously a very circumstantial case. But they had some nice bombshells that landed, I think, Friday. And to back up for a second, Rick, you know, that is a sign of a serious prosecutor that he or she knows that they want to finish strong. You know, you want to start strong, finish strong, recency and primacy. And so the jury got to hear some pretty compelling evidence near the end. And some of that, really all of it, goes to the notion of whether or not Alex Murdaugh had an alibi at the time that the murders took place. Just as a reminder of the basics of the case, Alex Murdaugh is actually accused of killing his wife and son, Maggie and Paul, at a piece of property where they typically held dogs and went hunting. And he created for himself what appeared to be an alibi in the beginning of visiting his mother, who was basically bedridden with dementia. Well, the alibi continued to crumble to the point of complete destruction by the end of the government's case. A couple of areas that were very powerful. One is they called three different witnesses to listen to a video recording from the phone of Paul Murdaugh, created just moments before his death. And in all of those cases, the witnesses said, I 100% can tell you I'm hearing the voices of Paul, Mother Maggie, and Father Alex in those videos that, again, are completely inconsistent with the alibi that Alex tried to set up. The other thing they had that's really much more of a tech piece of circumstantial evidence is data from the car. You know, cars, modern-day cars, essentially have their own black boxes to help you recreate where they've been. And in this case, the car data shows two huge things at Alex's expense. One is that he only spent at most about 20 minutes at his mother's residence. To fill the alibi that he was trying to create, he needed to stay there 45 to 60 minutes. And that's what he told the police, was that he was there in the vicinity of an hour. And he was actually very aggressively trying to tell his mom's caregiver that he had been there 45 to 60 minutes. And she said, no, you're only there 20 minutes. So her testimony was soundly corroborated by the data from the car showing that he had left that area after about 20 minutes. The other thing that's really intriguing, and it's circumstantial, but it's a powerful piece of evidence. When they found Maggie's body, her cell phone was nowhere to be found. Well, they eventually found the phone down the road a little bit, and Alex's vehicle drove at a steady pace, got to the location where he would have thrown that telephone out the window, and then sped up dramatically. And so it really was a good piece of, again, circumstance, kind of filling in the blanks, but a powerful piece of evidence to suggest that he was absolutely involved in the murder. And I've heard some commentators say, you know, his alibi defense is starting to look weak. I think it's probably beyond that. It's not that he doesn't have an alibi. It's that they've conclusively established that he created a false alibi, and that's the kind of thing that innocent people don't usually do. So good week's end for the prosecution. We'll see where it goes next week with the defense. They originally said they'd take about a week. I'm sure that's going to shrink to days and probably gets to the jury very end of next week or into the beginning of next week.
We saw the tragic shooting at Michigan State University and a lot of questions about the shooter and his background, and it was not his first brush with the law.
No, and, you know, Rick, I'm not the quickest one to get into these kind of collateral blame stories where, you know, everybody else should be the one that stopped this from happening. But I think this is a legitimate, blameworthy story about progressive prosecution. There's a progressive prosecutor, big George Soros-funded kind of person named Carol Simon, who was the local prosecutor from 2017 to 2022 up near Michigan State. And her office was given the message from her that they wanted to be much softer in their approach to cases involving firearms. And in fact, they were. She memorialized that policy in 2021, saying from now on, felony gun cases are going to be dropped down to misdemeanors because they disproportionately affect black residents. That was her words in justifying how felony gun cases should always be reduced. Well, she reduced the case involving the Michigan State shooter, her office did, from a felony to a misdemeanor, and that has serious consequences. The first being that in 2019, when he pled guilty, he got probation instead of getting a mandatory minimum two-year sentence. But more importantly, without a felony conviction, he was able to go buy a firearm, and he did so before the slaughter of three innocents and the wounding of others and his suicide at Michigan State. So this is a pretty direct moment where progressive ideas about, you know, class warfare and the need to have equities in the court and the judicial system, you know, really backfires into a situation where you're letting somebody who's already proven to be criminal in some ways to become much more dangerous and much more enabled to do what he did.
The irony is the progressives typically want to increase the regulations on guns, yet if they do, the progressive prosecutors are not going to enforce the laws.
Right. There's a real inconsistency in that approach that, you know, you're saying we already have enough laws, and then you turn around and you soften them through your own use of discretion. Yeah, and this district attorney had, I think, a very feeble defense to the whole situation. She said, well, 95% of all cases are resolved by pleas, and that's a classic truism. Yeah, that's true, but that doesn't mean you have to create misdemeanor policies for felony handgun situations. And in fact, if you look at the paperwork from that underlying case, he was sitting in front of an abandoned house with a loaded 380 semi-automatic handgun on his person, and they let him plead to a misdemeanor carrying a firearm inside a vehicle. Like, it's not even factually true, but they were so strong-willed about coming up with a alternative non-felony that's what his plea was. So, you know, I think you're right. There's a real inconsistency. The other lesson that I would take from this is, you know, a lot of people on both sides of the aisle get alarmed about mandatory minimum sentences. And certainly that's true in federal drug cases and sometimes in the state system like this case or these types of cases. But the reality is mandatory minimums only come into play when the community is tired of softness, when they think the judges or the prosecutors are using their discretion in a dangerous way from the community's perspective. So they get frustrated and they pass mandatory minimums. And this is what happens when you feel self-righteous about a mandatory minimum is you avoid the entire charge and you have them plead to misdemeanor. So, you know, I think it's a reminder that there's a reason why we have legislatures that come together and impose mandatories. And Carol Simon's treatment of the Michigan State shooter is Exhibit A.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law. As always, Jim, thank you very much. And you can follow Jim on Twitter at Trusty Lawyer. Jim, thank you very much.
Sure, thanks. Have a good weekend.
You too. And we've got the 7 o'clock news next with Heather Curtis, then back with John Gizzi, Cheryl Atkinson, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, and K.T. McFarland. Stay with us.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9. WMAL-FM.